The scripture reading tonight will come from Jeremiah chapter 6, 6 through 10. For thus has the Lord of hosts said, cut down trees and build a mound against Jerusalem. This is the city to be punished. She is full of oppression in her midst. A fountain wells up with water. So she wells up with her wickedness. Violence and plundering are heard in her. Before me continually are grief and wounds. Be instructed, O Jerusalem, lest my soul depart from you, lest I make you desolate, a land not inhabited. Thus says the Lord of hosts, they shall thoroughly glean as a vine the remnant of Israel, as a grape gatherer, put your hand back into the branches. To whom shall I speak and give warning, that they may hear? Indeed, their ear is uncircumcised. They cannot give heed. Behold, the word of the Lord is a reproach to them. They have no delight in it.
Well, last month we spent some time in 1 Samuel chapter 25, studied the narrative that is recorded there. And in doing so, we thought a little bit about the stupidest man in the Bible, the wisest woman in the Bible, the oddest couple in the Bible, and perhaps some estimations, the angriest man in the Bible. Then last week, we talked about the wickedest man in the Bible, perhaps Manasseh. This evening, I want us to think about the saddest story in the Bible. And of course, there are a lot of sad stories in the Bible. But when you start looking through those sad stories, sometimes they are not thoroughly sad. They are, in some ways, mixed with some kind of sense of rejoicing that God is finally visiting just punishment on those who deserve it. You think about the sad story, of course, of Noah and his life and the wickedness of his day and the flood. But that was, in some ways, a starting over again. A new beginning for mankind, as demonstrated by the rainbow in the sky. Or you may think about the crucifixion of Jesus, and certainly we are saddened when we see him portrayed before our eyes as crucified, but mixed with that clearly is the sense of joy that it was through his death and his resurrection that we are made alive. And of course, when you think about the saddest stories in the Bible, that period of time in which Jeremiah worked, as represented by those verses that Brad read for us, certainly a sad story. The wickedness of Jerusalem having reached the point where God could no longer tolerate it, and he brought in the Chaldeans to destroy them. But once again, in some ways, that is a new beginning, because even in the midst of that story, God is preserving a remnant with which he will start over again and bring into the world the Christ through whom we all have hope. But you think about the individual story of Jeremiah, the work that he did and the way in which his life ended as he was forcibly taken out of Jerusalem and down into Egypt. And that's a pretty sad story. But I want to suggest to you another story that's sad in a different kind of way, and that's found in Mark, the sixth chapter. In Mark, the sixth chapter, we recognize that we are in the gospel, the good news of Jesus Christ. And particularly as you're familiar with the Gospels, you'll recognize that Mark is characterized by that expression that he likes to use straight away or immediately in some of the translations. And he goes from one event in the life of Jesus to another, moving toward the accumulating event, the end towards which it was all pointed, his resurrection and his glorification, and thus our opportunity for salvation. But in Mark chapter 6, we find a story that is not about Jesus, perhaps the only one in all of the Gospel of Mark that is not about Jesus. In Mark chapter 6, and I'll begin in verse 13, as there is some mention here of Jesus, or verse 12 and 13 of his apostles. They went out and they preached that men should repent, and they were casting out many demons and were anointing with oil many sick people and healing them. And King Herod heard of it, and his name had become well known, and people were saying, John the Baptist has risen from the dead, and that's why these miraculous works are at work in him. But others were saying he's Elijah, and others were saying he's a prophet like one of the prophets of old. But when Herod heard of it, he kept saying, John, whom I beheaded, is arisen. And kept saying, John, whom I beheaded, has arisen. For Herod himself had sent and had John arrested and bound in prison on account of Herodias, the wife of his brother Philip, because he'd married her. For John had been saying to Herod, it's not lawful for you to have your brother's wife. Herodias had a grudge against him and wanted to put him to death and could not do so. For Herod was afraid of John, knowing that he was a righteous and a holy man, and he kept him safe. And when he heard him, he was very perplexed, but he used to enjoy listening to him. A strategic day came when Herod, on his birthday, gave a banquet for his lords and military commanders and the leading men of Galilee. And when the daughter of Herodias herself came in and danced, she pleased Herod and his dinner guest. And the king said to the girl, ask me for whatever you want, and I will give it to you. And he swore to her, whatever you ask of me, I will give it to you, up to half of my kingdom. And she went out and she said to her mother, what shall I ask for? And she said, the head of John the Baptist. Immediately she came in a hurry to the king, and she asked, saying, I want you to give me at once the head of John the Baptist on a platter. And although the king was very sorry, yet because of his oath and because of his dinner guest, he was unwilling to refuse her. Immediately the king sent an executioner and commanded him to bring back the head. And he went and had him beheaded in prison, and borrowed his head on a platter, and he gave it to the girl, and the girl gave it to her mother. When the disciples heard about this, they came and took away his body and laid it in a tomb. And there's a pretty sad story. And in some ways, it seems like there's nothing really good in this story. Oh, there's one good person, that's John the Baptist, of course, but it's a story about how he died, and it's not like particularly a heroic death. It's a pretty grisly death, as a matter of fact, and not a death that probably John would have chosen for himself. It doesn't even really smack in some ways of the typical martyr's death, where he is challenged about, do you believe, and refuses to disavow his beliefs and is put to death as a result of that. He is beheaded in prison, and then his head is paraded through the banquet hall. And of course, the other people in the story, Herodias and Herod and Herodias' daughter, they are pretty vile people, apparently. So you wonder, you know, what's relevant about this story? Why is it included in the Bible? Why is it included in particular Mark, which is very kind of careful to select events in the life of Jesus that move toward the culminating, accumulating end of Jesus' life? So I think maybe we think about these characters a little bit. Maybe we'll see if we can find something useful in kind of the way that Gary did this morning in the story of that exceptional man, David's life. Herodias is maybe in some ways the villain of the whole story. And she's married to Herod Antipas at this point in time, but she herself was the granddaughter of Herod the Great. And she was first of all married to Philip, who was a son of Herod the Great. So she was married to her uncle. And he, of course, was a tetrarch, but not really royalty. He just had a governorship. And his brother, Herod Antipas, this Herod here in Mark chapter 6, came to visit with his brother Philip. They didn't really like one another very well, but when Herod Antipas saw Philip's wife, Herodias, he thought he was smitten and in love. And the story goes that she was very beautiful. That's just on the outside, of course, as you can tell by her character in this story. And theirs, I suppose, is a love story that Hollywood would love, because I guess Herod thought only Herodias understood him, and she thought perhaps only Herod Antipas understood him. Actually, it's pretty clear she wanted to be a queen and have a crown, and Philip didn't provide that for her. So she sent Herod Antipas back to his home. He divorced his wife, started a war, actually, that almost resulted in Jerusalem being taken over at that point in time, except that the Romans had intervened, and sent her away. And then she divorced Philip and came down and joined him. And they're living here in Jerusalem. And it is amazing that, you know, that's the kind of story that Hollywood would make a movie out of and glorify. They get everything wrong, it seems, in Hollywood. And this Herodias is like a really, really bad person. And I don't care how lovely she was on the outside, she really was a bad person. And Herod, pretty bad person by himself, but much the worst kind of person because of his association with Herodias. This Herod Antipas was the king, and he had had a liaison with the neighboring king to the south through the wife that he first was married to, but he'd sent her away because for some reason he loved this Herodias. And it was like, you know, her willingness to come with him and to leave her brother really doesn't excuse him. That's for sure about that. And when they got to Jerusalem, they aroused the curiosity and really in some ways the shame of the whole country. Because the people knew that wasn't quite the way people are supposed to behave. Of course, they're royalty, so you expect them to behave in unusual kinds of ways. But most of the people who understood that what they had done was a wrong kind of thing, a sinful kind of thing, a shameful kind of thing, like Leviticus chapter 20 and verse 20 specifically had said, here they are in the land of the Jews, supposedly they're Jews. Leviticus chapter 20 and verse 21, if there's a man who takes his brother's wife, it's abhorrent. And they'll be childless as a consequence of that. It's an abomination to be married to his brother's wife. And divorce and all of that kind of stuff. And this, but the people aren't going to say anything about that. Because after all, they're the king and the queen. But there's one guy who is going to say something about that, and that's John the Baptist. And John the Baptist is going to preach about that. Everywhere people are listening to him, he is decrying the wickedness of the country and the way in which that's represented by the king and the queen at the top. I don't know if John, in his plain-spoken way, used that old proverb that the fish rots from the head down, but that's the idea he would have been preaching about. And Herodias, she hated him as a result of that, and she wanted him dead, as the account in Matthew tells us. Herod, he couldn't bring himself to put him to death, because as Mark tells us, he knew he was a righteous man. And besides, he'd like to hear him. He was puzzled by what John had to say, but he liked to hear him, and so he had him put in prison. Maybe he'd have been better off if Herod had killed him. Because John, you remember, was wilderness raised. He ate the wild locusts and the honey, and he wore the leathern girdle, and he was out in the wilderness, and the people went out to hear him. But now Herod has taken him, put him in a little prison, and shut him up away from the wide open spaces and from the people that he needed to preach to. And there he languishes in that prison. And Herod, I guess, would have him brought out occasionally, paraded in front of him, so he could hear him preach. It's like he's perplexed, but he likes to hear him. And you wonder, what kind of a man is that? He likes to hear preaching, and I'm pretty sure John didn't tell him what he wanted to hear. And it's like, man, this guy's got something, Herod thinks. I'm sure glad he's in prison, and then he sends him back again. And he's not going to do what John tells him to do, that's for sure. Herod couldn't bring himself to kill him now. But Herodias, she is like, this guy has got to die. From her selfish point of view, from her high and lofty position with her tiara on her head, she's like some politicians today. She's like, it's no good wearing a crown if trash like that can say whatever they want to about me. So he has got to go. But Herod's not going to put him to death. So she's like plotting, we got to get this guy killed. Because she was thoroughly selfish and thoroughly immoral. She wanted him dead because she wanted to live the way she wanted to live with no interference from anybody, particularly not some dirty prophet out of the wilderness. She wanted to benefit from her sin and not have it pointed out that it was a sin. She wanted a life with no rules, at least no rules for her. I'm pretty sure she had rules for everybody else. Like the wicked queen in Alice in Wonderland, off with their head. But she wanted to do what she wanted to do. And most of all, she didn't want anybody reminding her that there was a God in heaven that had certain kind of rules for her and everybody else, and a judgment day was coming. She was so petulant and so vengeful that she wasn't satisfied that John was in prison. She plotted. Because that's what it says in Mark 6 and verse 25, 21. A strategic day came. a convenient day, an opportune day, which suggests she'd been looking for just such an occasion as this. Just such an occasion where she could work on Herod and get him to give her what she wanted, the death of John the Baptist. And this was Herod's birthday. And Herod has a big party. And I suppose, I don't know how much detail she'd worked out about this, but she thinks maybe on his birthday he's going to be in a good mood. Maybe I get him a really good present. Then he will give me something in return. He'd be so grateful. This is an evidence of how badly she wanted this. She used her daughter to get what she wanted. I don't know if that was what the plan was all along, if she'd been working toward this moment, cultivating Herod's interest in her daughter for some time. But that's the way it works out on this convenient, strategic day. Now, Herodias' daughter is, by Josephus, named Salome. And she's traditionally been viewed as a seductress. And in movies and opera, she's portrayed as a grown-up woman. In art, she is an iconic symbol of lasciviousness in the Strauss opera. She dances the disgraceful at that point in time, though it's just kind of common stuff on television today. The disgraceful dance of the seven veils, which so inflames Herod that he foolishly offers her half of his kingdom. But the truth of the matter is, in the Bible, she is only identified as a girl. And the Bible only says that the dance pleases him. Which may just be the Bible being tasteful about this tawdry story, maybe. But the language of the Bible does not require that she be this kind of seductress woman who deliberately is inveigling him to get something out of him. It's certainly true that this is a birthday feast that Herod has given just for men, for the commanders, for the nobles, for the highfalutin men, and there would have been no honorable women involved, probably. And it may very likely be, given the decadent nature of Herod and Antipas, that there was a lot of drinking going on. But in the beginning, and until the 6th century, Salome was perceived as a young girl. A young girl who is nonetheless shamelessly exhibited to these men, perhaps these drunken men, by her incestuous mother. But she has become over the years something maybe that she really wasn't. The word that's used in the New Testament, the Greek word here, is that of a young girl, or a damsel, as the King James Version translates it. And in Mark chapter 5, we've met another damsel, another young girl, and that word's not used very frequently in the New Testament. But we meet this young girl that's damsel who is, it turns out, Jairus' daughter, the young girl who is sick, and Jesus goes to her home and she has already died. And of course, if she is just a young girl, and the young girl in Mark chapter 5, we know, is 12 years old. And that would be what the intent of young girl would be. 12, maybe 13, maybe 14, but still a young girl, not full-grown woman. Of course, that doesn't make this story any less distasteful. It makes it a little less lascivious, perhaps, at least on the part of Salome. But it is a male party, and typically only women that were going to be involved in this male party, particularly if they were drinking going on, would have been the slaves and the prostitutes who would have been brought in to do the dancing. And it's true that Herodias herself is not at this party. Because when Herod says to the girl, I'll give you whatever you want, up to half my kingdom I'll give it to you, she has to go out to ask her mother because her mother is not here. It's highly improper that this girl should be there, that this girl should be dancing in front of these men, particularly if these men were drinking. We see really in some ways two damsels, one in chapter 5, one in chapter 6, in considerably different circumstances. And really, that may be the point of the story here, this story here in chapter 6. Here it is what life is like without Jesus. These people are without God. They have no interest in Jesus. Herod, the only thing he can think about later on when he hears about Jesus' miracles is, oh no, that's John the Baptist come back from the dead and he's going to start preaching bad things about me again. This is the sadness of the story. This is where those words in Jeremiah chapter 6 really apply. This is desolation. Not desolation in the sense that there is economic desolation, but desolation of the soul and desolation of the spirit here in the palace of Herod. That this kind of play could be acted out. That this kind of use could be made of a young girl. One damsel in Mark chapter 5 has two loving parents. And she's in a religious household. She's in a household that believes in Jesus. Maybe they've been brought to belief in Jesus just by the desperate circumstances of their daughter being sick, but that indicates all the more how much they care about this daughter. And it indicates, too, that they're not completely opposed to the message that Jesus is preaching. They'd be willing to accept that if he could provide for them this boon of saving their daughter. The other one in Mark chapter 6 is being used as a tool of incestuous mother in front of drunken men at a birthday party. And you may think, what's the fate of these two young damsels? You know, we don't have words like that anymore. We don't use the word damsel. Even the modern translation just say girl. But it's one of the things about maybe the King's English, King James English. And that translation, damsel suggests a young girl, but more than that, a young girl of quality. Both of these young girls have bright, shiny future in front of them. They've already been bent in one direction or the other by the time they've reached this age, I am certain. But there still lies before them the potential of a bright and a beautiful future. We have no idea what happens with the daughter of the head of the synagogue, Jairus, as he is named. We may suppose, we may hope, that she reached adulthood. She always remembered that her life was a gift, a loving gift, a miracle that Jesus had given her, and that she lived her life in the sense of that. And of course, that's true of each and every one of us too, who have reached adulthood, that in some ways it is a gift of God. He didn't have to give it to us. And even more so, think about this. Those of us who have been baptized and been born again, we have the same kind of sense of renewal, the same kind of sense of a second chance at life, the same kind of sense of it is all before us again. And the obligation as a result of that to live our lives for Jesus who gave us this new life. But this other girl, Salome, well, you know, we know she ended up being married twice herself later to two more of this terrible Herod clan people. And nothing good is told about her in subsequent history. I wonder to what extent this moment in time, if in fact she is a young girl, 12 years old, 13, and she's been forced by a mother into this room and dancing for these men. And then she is in the bewilderment of a girl when the king says, you can have whatever you want, up to half my kingdom. And it's like, you know, if he just said, you know, what do you want? Say, well, I'd like a doll and, you know, maybe a pony or something of that nature. But he says, something big. You need to ask for something big. And maybe your mother's already tutored her. You know, you come and ask me. She goes out and says, what should I ask for? What can I get? What big thing could I have? Maybe she's already got her eyes focused on jewels or something of that nature. And her mother says, you go back and you ask for John the Baptist's head on a platter. And the girl goes and she says, I want John the Baptist's head on a platter. And then they bring it to her. Can you imagine what a sight that must have been? And how that must have affected her? And of course, that's just a small part of the corruption that's taken place by being living in this context of this world without Jesus, without God. It's a pretty sad story. The story also may suggest something else to us too, as tawdry as it is. We may also think about that head of John the Baptist brought in on a platter. Here it is, a banquet, a feast. And they look around to find something appropriate to bring the head of John the Baptist in. I've never seen anyone beheaded, but I'm sure it's kind of messy. You don't just bring it in dripping. That's what they do in the Greek tragedies. But in this civilized time, they had to keep it off the marble floor and off the carpets. So they put it on a platter and they bring it in at a banquet. And I don't know, but it does look like there's a world of difference between what happens here at this banquet and what happens in the next chapter of Mark, where they feed the 5,000, where Jesus breaks the fishes and the loaves and feeds the 5,000. What a contrast between this grotesque kind of parody of a plate, a platter, and the health-giving feast that the Lord prepares. There's another lesson here too, and that's the unsavory influence of an evil woman. I mean, Herod on his own, I don't think would ever have managed to behead John. Maybe it's just as bad to keep him locked up in prison, but I don't think he ever would have had him put to death. He liked to listen to him too much. It was like puzzle. It's like, wow, you should hear this guy. He's like, I can't understand a thing he says, but it is just like amazing to listen to him. But Herodias, she wanted him dead, and she got him dead, and she got her husband to put him to death. And you think about Jezebel and Ahab. Ahab by himself, I'm pretty sure, never would have killed Naboth. He would have just sulked about that. Maybe crowded him off his land. But Jezebel, evil woman that she was, and evil influence that she had on the kingdom of Israel, incredible. Of course, there's the positive side of women's influence too. No doubt about that. You've heard the saying, behind every great man, there's a great woman. Behind every good man, there's a good woman. Well, maybe this is true too. Behind every evil man, there's an evil woman. Sure seem to be examples of that. And you just, I mean, that's not surprising, because in fact, when God made the woman, he made a help suitable for the man. He made somebody who could get the job done. It's not as if somehow he made an inferior kind of person when he made the woman. He made a help suitable. And when you make a help meet, as the King James Version has it, then that's somebody who can get the job done, as long as they're pointed in the right direction. And we see Herodias and her evil influence. There's also the sad story of John the Baptist to be considered in this story. He is the last, think about this, the last of the Old Testament prophets. Some ways that's what it means when they say he's the voice of Elijah crying in the wilderness. Elijah was in many ways the paragon of the Old Testament prophets. How you could put him above Isaiah or Jeremiah or any of the rest of them, I don't know. But for the Jews, Elijah, you know, crying in the wilderness was the typical view of a powerful Old Testament prophet. And here's John the Baptist crying in the wilderness, the voice of Elijah, preparing the way of the Lord. He did the final paving of the way of the Lord, though all of those prophets in one way or another paved the way of the Lord. All of them were pointing to the future and the coming of the Messiah. But here's the last of the Old Testament prophets. And we're not surprised then, really, that the old has to pass away, that the new can take its place. And we're not surprised at the way in which John died. That he didn't live to a ripe old age, but he was put to death for his preaching in the way that so many of the Old Testament prophets were put to death. There's so many references in the New Testament to the death of those Old Testament prophets. In Matthew chapter 5, even on the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says in Matthew 5 and verse 11, "Blessed are you when people insult you and persecute you and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, your reward in heaven is great, for in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you." And in Matthew chapter 23, and in verse 31, he says to those Pharisees who are standing before him in Matthew 23, verse 31, "You testify against yourselves that you are the sons of those who murdered the prophets." The blood of the prophets stained almost every corner of Jerusalem, apparently. No surprise, then, that John's blood is added to that. That his name is added to the list of those prophets who were put to death. In many ways, it's interesting that it is the death of John the Baptist that kind of segues into this whole kind of accumulation of the story that Mark is telling about the death of the Messiah. That these prophets all came and they testified about him and they were put to death. And as the parable says in Matthew chapter 21, the parable of the landowner, the absent landowner who sent his messengers to the tenants and they killed them one after the other. And then he said, I'll send my son and they'll respect my son. And he sent his son and they killed him too. Here the prophets are, one after the other. Here's the last, John the Baptist. And now here already on the scene is the son himself who they're going to kill. Just as they had the prophets. But there's a difference between John the Baptist's death and the death of all those other prophets and the death of Jesus. And that is that Jesus comes knowing full well that he's going to die. And that he's going to die to fulfill all righteousness. He's going to die so that he may make people alive again. He goes to his death willingly, and that makes all the difference for us, for John, for all those other prophets. There's a sense in which there's a message of life in this story. It's not that the Bible just is recording something and here's a chronology and we got to tell the story. No, there's a reason why these stories are recorded and recorded in these sequence. And a part of it is about the whole puzzle about Jesus. Who is Jesus? That's how the story starts, remember? When he was preaching and his disciples were out preaching and they were performing miracles and King Herod heard of it, for his name had become well known and the people were saying, John the Baptist has risen from the dead. That's why these miraculous powers are at work in him. And others were saying, no, he's Elijah. And others were saying he's a prophet like one of the prophets of old. Herod heard of it. He kept saying, John whom I beheaded has risen again. John whom I beheaded has risen again. Practically mad about that. But in some ways, Herod was a prophet too. It isn't that Jesus is John the Baptist, arisen from the dead. But it is true that Jesus is going to come back from the dead. He's right about that. He's just a little wrong about the chronology. And it is true too that the resurrection of Jesus Christ is the light of the world. It is the light that shines back even on tawdry stories like this and says there is some hope. If they had just listened to the preaching of the gospel, the same way we studied last week, that Manasseh was able to turn to the Lord and even after 20 years of doing evil and blaspheming God. If these people, Herod, Herodias, Salome, had believed in Jesus Christ, they could have been redeemed too. That's the story of life that is in Jesus. This is a sad story. And this would be a sad world, and every story would be sad, except for the resurrection of Jesus Christ. As Peter says in 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 3, he's caused us to be born again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. We may wonder a little bit about why this story is here, but when we read it in the context, I think it's pretty clear that it suggests to us, if nothing else, a contrast. A world without Jesus and righteousness is a sad, sad, tragic world. But a world in which there is a Jesus, a world in which the Jesus that we know and love, that Jesus the Christ has died and come back from the dead, that's a world in which there is light and hope and redemption. And that really is the good news, isn't it? So we ask the question as we stand and sing, will you follow Jesus? You got those two choices in life. The one leads to light, joy, and life, following Jesus. The other, well, here it is, recorded in Mark chapter 6 in the household of Herod and Herodias. An easy choice to make. Let's follow Jesus. Let's encourage one another as we stand and sing this song.